Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Last night, President Trump responded with force to recent criticism that he has not properly addressed anti-Semitic hate and vandalism across the country. It was the first topic of his 60-plus minute address to a joint session of Congress.
Recent threats targeting Jewish community centers and vandalism of Jewish cemeteries, as well as last week's shooting in Kansas City, remind us that while we may be a nation divided on policies, we are a country that stands united in condemning hate and evil in all of its very ugly forms.
We're going to review the rest of the president's address this hour. Joining us is Ohio State University political scientist Paul Beck. Welcome back, Paul.
Good to be with you, Ann.
Also, Republican strategist Bob Clegg. Welcome back, Bob.
Thanks, Ann.
And by phone, D.C. Bureau Chief for the Columbus Dispatch, Jack Torrey. Welcome, Jack.
Doing fine. How are you this morning?
Good. Right off the bat, his tone was different. What did you make of that, Jack Torrey?
Different tone, still a very tough message. The anti-immigrant rhetoric, I thought, was very tough. He had let out during the day that he might be open to some sort of bipartisan reform on immigration. But the way he spelled it out in his speech last night, he either took it back or basically announced that I'll be glad to do a bipartisan immigration reform as long as I get my way.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very conservative message on health care and taxes and a populist, non-conservative agenda on international trade. So I found it to be well-delivered. I mean, I was following the script and listening to him at the same time, and only a couple times did he get off script. When he said a great, great wall in the original script, it was just a great wall, so I guess he decided to ad-lib an additional great.
And that's a classic Trump ad-lib anyways, hyperbole. Paul Beck, it sounded like, we were talking earlier, Jack Torrey confirmed that I wasn't following the script, but a lot of this has to do with the fact that he stuck to the script.
Oh, I think that's right. It was a very different tone from the usual Trump speeches, certainly the campaign speeches, but even the inaugural address. To me, it was a welcome change in tone. I think he's buckling down now to the hard work of governing. And what I saw in the speech that I found particularly interesting is that he, in a way, was hurling two challenges out there. One to people in his own party to translate what is a laundry list of promises into policy without much direction from him in most cases. The other one was a challenge to Democrats, this idea of unity, not to get down, you know, fighting over trivial kinds of things. He probably will need some Democratic votes for some of the things that he's proposed, certainly the infrastructure plan. And so in a way, he's challenging Democrats to try to get beyond the kind of partisan polarization that has been out there. Whether that works or not, or whether it even works in terms of challenging his own party, we'll see. I think the proof is going to be in the policy making and the detail.
You know, it's interesting the way you put it. He was challenging Democrats to do something.
Yes.
And you know, Bob Clegg, it wasn't the same as extending an olive branch to the Democrats, right? There's a distinction
no,
there,
I don't
right?
think that's the Trump way. But politically, I thought the speech was very much focused to the people that voted for him, very much. I mean, basically, he did the laundry list of this is what I promised on the campaign trail, and this is what I've delivered so far, and this is what I want to deliver. And like Jack just mentioned, what I found, one part of it that I found interesting was the health care portion of it. He pretty much adopted the Paul Ryan model for healthcare reform, which I found interesting because he has given some signals before this that made you think that maybe he wouldn't be following that road. He might be going down a
different
road.
Well, they said
road.
They had their own version on the way.
But the version
to
he
Congress.
Talked about was pretty much Paul Ryan's version.
What about that, Jack Torrey?
Well, it was vague enough that if you were John Kasich or Paul Ryan, you could say, I think he's listening to me.
Yeah.
He said, we need to scrap Obamacare, and we need to replace it with a market-oriented system. And then he said, but for the people on Medicaid, we've got to adopt some flexibility for the governors so nobody gets left behind.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the problem with that is the House Republicans are so divided, as former Speaker Boehner said last week. You know, this is all happy talk right now. There's very little chance, and I've been wrong before, and I'll be wrong again. I just don't see where they're going to agree on anything to replace it with. My own prediction is Obamacare will largely be in place going into the 2018 elections, because every time they come up with a way to change it, I mean, you have the very conservative Republicans in the Republican Study Group, which is Jim Jordan and about 80 other people, who just want to repeal the law, right? They think even the plan outlined last week is too liberal for them. So it's a very, very tough thing. What he essentially did was he said, here's the roadmap. You guys fill in the details and I'll sign it.
Going back to, you know, his first utterances in the speech last night, what does it mean? I mean, does he take to heart, or does the people who wrote the speech take to heart the criticism he was getting for failing to confront head on the anti-Semitism, the vandalism, and the threats, Jack Tory?
Well, I think that's they were trying to convey that. I mean, Trump, you know, he plays this game very differently than the rest of us. I actually don't think he's anti-Semitic in any way, shape, or form.
Mm-hmm.
But I think at times he's very tone-deaf. Somehow, they got him to agree to deliver a speech with a teleprompter. No ad-libbing, which except for three. And and he stuck to the script.
Right.
And I think they felt that they had to address that, because the vast majority of Americans are not racist and anti-Semitic. And they don't want to, they want to tone that stuff down. They don't want to see that type of vandalism. And so I think they felt they should get that out of the way at the beginning. But it's a sign that when somebody says, you have to do this, he'll do it. And I suspect it's his son-in-law and his daughter who had a big impact on the speech.
Yeah, you know, Bob Clegg, you said he spoke to the people who voted for him, but he spoke in a different way.
Yeah, different tone.
Different tone. And I've often watched him when he was on the campaign trail.
Yes.
When he stuck to script.
Which I was just going to bring that up.
Very
at the
noticeable.
Very end of the campaign, I want to say the last 7 to 10 days,
yeah,
he was on teleprompter,
yes,
the whole time.
Yeah.
And he stuck to it. And I think what they're trying to tell him is, look how well you did when you were on the campaign, yeah, trail doing it. You got to get back to that.
And as a strategist.
Oh, yeah. He definitely should be back to that.
And he's got his way of going off script. George Voinovich had his way of going off script. You know, all different, you know, everybody has their own way of going off script, his way.
But he really goes off script.
Yeah, he really goes off script.
Well, and what we should watch for is he not only goes off script in his speeches, but then there are the tweets afterward.
Yeah.
And I haven't heard any this morning.
Yeah, were there any?
I don't know.
And he only had one after the Oscars, which I thought was,
yeah,
amazing.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they may be even trying to get that under control.
Yeah, yeah. He reiterated a lot of his campaign trail promises, which goes to Bob Clegg's point about talking to his voters, but he didn't offer many details on what he would do about these things. I mean, people, unless you're really, really in the know, you don't really know that much about the Paul Ryan model and that kind of a thing. Did he tell you anything new, you know, that you think is of note, Paul Beck?
Well, maybe a couple of things. One is there's been talk about $1 trillion being invested in infrastructure, and you hear this from time to time in the early days of the administration. He was telling us last night that basically is going to be deferred to probably next year. $1 trillion is a huge price ticket.
Well, yeah.
And a lot of conservatives in Congress, conservative Republicans, are going to resist that. Now, is he going to get help from the private sector in carrying that out? He's claimed that he will, but the way you do that is through tax credits, which, of course, hit them on the revenue side. So there are real issues there to deal with. This was the first time I've heard, at least in concrete form, that he was going to defer that. And so, you know, that was one thing. The other thing that struck me, you know, you always do fact-checking in this. There's a new claim in last night's talk, And that has to do with our NATO allies partnering more with us to provide more funding for NATO. And he talked, and it had to be an ad lib, that the money is rolling in. Well, it can't be rolling in, because what the pledge is, it's for them to spend more of their own money on armaments and defense. And, of course, that may happen, and I think it would be probably a good thing.
But there's no central source.
But it's not pouring into the federal treasury in the United States.
Yeah. Yeah. Jack Tory, what about the infrastructure issue and deferring it? That was one thing that I was really questioning whether Congress was going to be able to go for on both sides of the equation.
I think it is a big problem, but it's the one area where he has common ground with many Democrats.
Right.
However, the word deficit, I think I heard it once last night. The United States government, according to the latest Congressional Budget Office analysis, before Trump does anything, is going to add somewhere between $9.5 to $10 trillion in new publicly held debt during the next decade. Now, the publicly held debt is money that is, treasury bonds that are sold to foreign and domestic investors. Our country will be will have about a total of $25 trillion in publicly held debt by the year 2027. To say that Republicans are freaking out over this is an understatement. I mean, this goes against everything they believe. And so to add these huge new tax cuts, which don't pay for themselves, I'm sorry to tell them. And secondly, to throw a $1 trillion infrastructure plan out there, you're talking, you're exploding the deficit into territory that you can't even begin to deal with.
So somebody got to him and told him this, and now he's starting to pull back, and it's starting with a deferral for a year, and it could go on for 4 years.
Take your guess.
Okay.
I was just going to say, I think he's got too crowded an agenda for Congress to be able to deal with this year. So if we're talking about repeal and replacement of Obamacare, if we're talking about a major change in the structure of our taxation and reduction in taxes, and then all these issues about how you're going to fund an increase in defense spending. I was looking at the numbers the other day. The total EPA budget is $7 billion. Total. And he's talking about $54 billion in increase for defense. Well, it can't come out of EPA. If you turn to State Department and add State Department plus all the international aid programs, you come close to $50 billion, but he would have to eliminate those departments to be able to fund that kind of increase. If there's growth in the economy, those revenues obviously don't start coming in for a while. So there's a real problem there, to come back to Jack's point about the deficit. And there are a lot of Republicans, not all of them, but a lot of Republicans who are very much deficit hawks, and they really don't want to see any kind of spending programs that increase the national debt, even though they're going to face a vote before too long on increasing the debt ceiling.
Mm-hmm. Well, which is the reason why he never really mentioned the deficit. He mentioned the debt once, and that was only to say, you know, President Obama nearly doubled our debt. But it's an issue that he realizes that Republicans have a real problem with. Obviously, the Democrats don't. So I think he'll be taking that mindset when he starts dealing on this infrastructure bill and looking at Democrats to vote for it, that to cover, you know, those Republicans that are going to have a big problem with it.
We're going to talk about his relationship with Congress and more coming up. We're talking about kind of the day after President Trump's first speech to a joint session of Congress was last night, and we're following up today. You just heard from Bob Clegg, GOP strategist, also with me, Paul Beck, political scientist at OSU, and Jack Tory, D.C. Bureau Chief for the Columbus Dispatch. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Earlier this week, President Trump was famously quoted as saying nobody knew healthcare could be so complicated. The utterance triggered all manner of social media memes, and many doubt that Trump or Congress can deliver on campaign promises to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. But in his address last night before a joint session of Congress, the president reiterated his plans to dismantle Obamacare.
Action is not a choice. It is a necessity. So I am calling on all Democrats and Republicans in Congress to work with us to save Americans from this imploding Obamacare disaster.
We're talking about the president's address today. Still with us, OSU political scientist Paul Beck, Republican strategist Bob Clegg, and D.C. Bureau Chief for the Columbus Dispatch, Jack Torrey. If you have a question or comment, give us a call. 614-292-8513. We'd love to hear from Trump supporters today and find out what you thought of the speech. Did he speak to you? Did you like it? Were you nonplussed? Did you dislike it? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Now, we've talked about the issue of Obamacare, of the Affordable Care Act, one and the same, of course, and how he's going to kind of juggle that hot potato. Former Kentucky Governor Steve Beshear gave the official Democratic response last night. He covered a wide array of topics, including the Affordable Care Act.
You and your Republican allies in Congress seem determined to rip affordable health insurance away from millions of Americans who most need it. Does the Affordable Care Act need some repairs? Sure it does. But so far, every Republican idea to replace the Affordable Care Act would reduce the number of Americans covered.
Jack Torrey, what do you make of the Democratic response and how in particular they responded to the Affordable Care Act? They're doing some pretty plain speaking there with the former governor of Kentucky. He's laying it out very simply. He's not getting fancy, and it sounds like that's exactly what Republicans wish they had. Speaking for them.
You're exactly right. The simple message always trumps, and that's no pun.
Mm-hmm.
The complicated message. Well, here's the simple message. Republicans want to take away health coverage to middle-income and low-income people so that they can cut taxes for the wealthiest of Americans. Now, there's a winning message for Democrats. And for Republicans, it's going to finally dawn upon them that they're going to go into 2018 next year with one of the worst. And I don't know which scenario is worse. Either they won't be able to repeal the law, which means that their own strongest supporters are going to say, well, how many times do we have to send you there to get rid of this thing? Or they will repeal it, and suddenly millions of people will be without coverage. Newspapers and TV will be doing stories about, you know, Aunt Millie who lost her health coverage. And it's just going to, I don't see where this has a happy ending for the Republicans. Now, maybe they're smarter than I am, but I think what you pointed out is correct, Dan. This is a simple, easy message.
Bob Clegg?
Well, I mean, the president talked about it last night. I mean, the easiest thing for Republicans to do is just do nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, the way Obamacare was set up, it's going to fall apart within the next year or two.
But as the governor said, no one's saying there doesn't need work.
Yeah, well, Democrats haven't offered any suggestions of how to fix it, which if Hillary Clinton had won, they would have to have dealt with it because it is in really bad shape. So the question is, how do you, you know, what do you replace it with? How do you do it? You know, it's going to be a combination. I mean, Obamacare really is two different elements. There's the Medicaid expansion side, which covered the vast majority of people that are now covered under it. And then there's the subsidy, you know, federal exchange side. And you know, they can keep the Medicaid expansion in place, except it just costs a lot of money to do that. And that's the problem there. The more complicated is the other side with the subsidies and the federal exchanges. And I don't know how they're going to come up with a solution on that side of it.
And you agree with Jack Torrey then that what's the message going to be in 2018? They can't. It's a lose-lose situation for Republicans when it comes to that?
It could be. I mean, also remember, on a political basis, Obamacare cuts people that really rely on Obamacare don't vote for Republicans. So, I mean, if you look at it as straight voters and who gets upset, people that are going to be kicked off that shouldn't be kicked off are going to be more likely to be Democrat supporters anyway. So if you want to be cold and heartless here and look at it as a pure political calculus, if they can deal with people that have their – it's the people that already had – health insurance, where their costs have gone up, that's the Republican electorate. Okay, those are the people that were affected by it in that way. It wasn't people that didn't previously have coverage and now do, because those all fall under a lower socioeconomic line.
But the message, you know, the messaging is that kind of messaging going to come?
No, yeah. That's why you won't hear that.
Right.
I'm saying it, but I don't run for office, do I? Mm-hmm. I mean, but I mean, if you want to look at the political calculus of it, that's what it is.
Yeah.
And that's why, in the end, why Democrats suffered by passing it, because they wanted to extend coverage to a lot of people that needed coverage. But the people that already had coverage needed to pay for that. So that meant their health insurance went up. They never said that was going to happen. In fact, they said the opposite was going to happen. But all those people that had their premiums increased or had their plans changed that they didn't like or they lost their doctors, those are the people that were voting for the Republicans. And those are the people that Republicans, if they want to somehow break even here, are going to have to make happy.
Well, I should add, this is a big, complicated topic.
Yep.
So the president has recognized himself. And there are a couple of things about it. One is that the agenda for health care has changed because of Obamacare. 8 years ago, we wouldn't be talking about these kinds of things. We wouldn't be talking about, for instance, protecting people who had pre-existing conditions.
Right.
We wouldn't be talking about capping or removing the caps for lifetime coverage, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Secondly, on Medicaid itself, if you think of Ohio, there are kind of two categories of people who have been affected by the Medicaid expansion. One is the category of people who were quite poor, who maybe if they vote are Democratic voters more than Republican voters. But there's a second class of people, because what Ohio has done has been to expand Medicaid coverage beyond the poverty line. And there, the counties that are affected, I know this from looking at the figures, are Appalachian, Ohio, voting 25% Democratic in 2016. And so there are a lot of Republicans caught up in this. And now the expectation, it seems to me, is that people are going to be protected who have pre-existing conditions. Everybody's going to be able to get medical insurance in one way or another. Caps are not going to be in place. All the things that insurance companies did to try to protect themselves from losing money on insurance, now, because the agenda has changed, are going to be protected. How the Republicans in Congress, and it'll be the Republicans, mm-hmm. are going to be, if anybody, are going to be able to square that is, I think, going to be difficult. And I should add, if the ACA collapses, it collapses now on the Republicans' watch. And that's a very different thing politically than what we would have had, let's say, Hillary Clinton been elected and Obamacare began to collapse as it has been doing in some states.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're looking back at the president's speech last night to the joint session of Congress. Want to hear what you think about the speech? Give us a call, 614-292-8513. Particularly interested in hearing from Trump supporters and what they thought. If you voted for Donald Trump and want to know what you thought of the speech, did you hear what you were hoping to hear? 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Jack Torrey, the Associated Press, and lots of other news organizations put out fact checks on the address. There was a lot to check, even though there was kind of a lack of detail. But the overall speech seems to have been more carefully vetted for hyperbole. So, you know, we talked about earlier about the fact that he actually stayed on script. And so maybe all of his speeches are vetted for hyperbole. We don't know. But all things being equal, what jumped out at you as something that should be corrected, something that he didn't make clear, something that you think is important for people to know?
I'm doing this now from memory, but it was the millions of people pouring over the borders with their drugs and everything else.
Oh, that.
And I'm not sure that that can withstand any type of fact check. The other thing, too, is I think when you talk about premiums going up on health insurance, I don't think the Republicans are very careful in pointing out they're talking largely about the policies that were sold through the marketplaces, which are the exchanges. And so, as a result, yes, my health policy has gone up as well through Columbus Dispatch, but it hasn't had the type of huge increases that the policies sold through the exchange. And so it was like we're listening to that and you go, did anybody bother to check their own health insurance costs and see what's happening with them? But for a Trump speech, this was pretty good. I mean, you know, there was no like one with the biggest electoral landslide since Ronald Reagan. you know, I always joke that Obama would come up with misleading stuff. But it took a couple hours to fact check the whole thing. But Trump, it takes you about 5 minutes. I had the biggest landslide in history. Well, no, you didn't.
Let's hear from some callers. Jim in Arlington, you're on the air.
Hi, Ann. Hi. Thanks for picking up this morning.
You bet.
You know, I'm listening to all these words being bantered about, and I don't hear any facts from these two gentlemen. You know, they're within your audience there, or in your
studio?
Facility. Let's talk about some numbers here concerning health care. In 2016, we're on track to have $3.02 trillion in billing for medical care. 3.02, I think that's $200 billion at the end of that. Uh-huh. For medical care across the United States. We had 800,000 cardiac cases. We have over 1 million cancer cases. This year we've had the highest amount on record of highway automobile crashes, over 40,000 people killed, and with that, 250,000 peripheral injuries to people requiring hospitalization.
Okay.
Now, you see how all that gets to $3.02 trillion. There is no way on this green earth that 300 million people can pay that kind of fee, because if you divide 3.02 trillion by 300 plus million, you got an annual fee of over $10,000 for every man, woman, and child. So if you've got three people in a family, you're going to have an estimated bill to pay medical insurance of $30,000 a year. The numbers don't lie.
Okay.
How come I never hear anything like that?
Well, I think what we do here, and those numbers are troubling, obviously. What we do here is that the percentage of the GDP in the United States that goes for health care is the highest in the world by a factor of 2 or 3 to 1, in fact. And so some kind of cost containment has always been an issue when you talk about health care reform. I'm not sure the ACA did a particularly good job of cost containment, but that is an issue, and it's an issue that I think the country will have to face in one way or another, or healthcare expenditures will simply eat us alive.
Jim, thanks a lot for that call.
I agree with what Paul just said there. Here is the problem is both political parties are guilty of this. They talk about health care and campaigns. They make it sound simple, and it won't cost you anything. Here is the grim reality. Medicare, which is one of the three main drivers of our national deficit, I think the number is, I'm pulling this out of the, you know, like Ronald Reagan off of a Reader's Digest story or something. I think about 27% of Medicare's costs go into the last 3 weeks of life, right? We are dealing with the fact that Americans have a tremendous health care system. It works. We cure people of a lot of things. But the problem then becomes it costs more. So if you're in Canada where you have some forms of rationing on elective surgery, you get to wait in line or do things like that. In the United States, we don't want to do any of that. We like getting our health care now, quickly and efficiently.
I wait in line all the time for health care. I do not know what anybody's talking about when it comes to that. I've been waiting in line for 3 weeks to see my nurse practitioner. That's waiting in line. I don't understand that.
I think you should find another practitioner.
Well, okay, but I just think that I'd love to drill down to that waiting in line kind of
issue.
Well,
I think when you're talking like Canada, they have surgeries that have to be done that can't be done immediately. Here in the United States, when somebody's told, hey, you got to have your gallbladder out, they do it right then and there. In Canada, you got to wait. You know, and they stabilize you until you can get that surgery done. I think Jack's talking about that kind of waiting that goes on. And it is. It's our culture. It's something as basic as just the culture and the way we are. We want everything now. We want the best possible now. And that costs a lot of money.
Yeah. Yeah.
I suggest that, Ann, you call the Cleveland Clinic and they'll get you in tomorrow.
Well, the thing is it's not an emergency. I mean, you're talking about a gallbladder, that's one thing, but a lot of people need, you know, whatever removed or
hips,
whatever.
Knees, I mean, whatever.
Go to the VA, you'll wait longer.
People wait all the time for things that they don't have an emergency for because you have to wait in line because they're scheduling out for an emergency. Yeah. I mean, that's kind of the idea. So, anyways, we are off the track as we often get when it comes to public policy issues and talking about the Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, one and the same. I want to get back to the speech, and we will, with my guests, Bob Clegg, GOP strategist, Paul Beck, political scientist at OSU, and Jack Torrey, D.C. Bureau Chief for the Columbus Dispatch. I want to talk about the speech. What did you think, Trump voters, of Donald Trump's first speech before the joint session of Congress? This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Earlier this week, President Trump's executive order banning citizens from 7 Muslim-majority countries from entering the U.S. and temporarily suspending the entry of all refugees was harshly criticized after a chaotic rollout and several legal challenges. Last night, in his first speech to a joint session of Congress, Trump reiterated his concerns about immigration and terrorism.
It is not compassionate, but reckless to allow uncontrolled entry from places where proper vetting cannot occur.
It was reported this morning that the president has delayed plans to sign a reworked travel ban in the wake of the positive reaction to his address last night. Still with us is OSU political scientist Paul Beck. Paul, thanks again for joining us.
Good to be with you, Ann.
And Republican strategist Bob Clegg. Thanks again, Bob.
All right, Ann. Thanks.
And D.C. Bureau Chief for the Columbus Dispatch, Jack Torrey. Jack, thanks again.
Glad to be here.
Jack, a senior administration official told CNN that they want the executive order to have its own moment. It made me wonder if they are surprised at the positive response from the speech, first of all.
Well, as Bob would know better than I would, rule of politics is don't step on your message. And they have a positive reaction from last night's speech. And they decided, why do we want to step all over that? And we can put this out Friday or Sunday or whatever they want to do. And they're not going to have it take effect right away so that actually people at airports will be able to deal with this. The problem is, that's one of the areas where I thought the fact checkers could have hit him harder. He's talking about the refugee program. And believe me, of all the ways for terrorists to get into the country, the refugee program is the last one they would pick. It's almost a 2-year vetting process.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you could do, as Senator Portman has suggested, make the vetting even tighter. But that's not how most terrorists say, I think I'll go wait in line for 2 years, and then if I don't forget about committing an act of terror, I'll be all set. Usually what we have to face are homegrown terrorists and things like that. So it's one thing for him to say it's a nice vetting process, but that really is not the way. What you're doing in this process is you're keeping out immigrants who are the most ambitious and most likely to be successful here in the United States.
Bob Clegg, you agree with the description? You don't want to be stepping on your...
No, I don't think they do at all. And I think Jack's right. They have plenty of time to issue this executive order. But, you know, also realize this is Trump. And Jack may have made a good point. I don't know. I'm not aware of how they do this refugee vetting program and how long it takes and all that. But this was something that was big on the campaign trail.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he constantly compared his stance on refugees versus Hillary Clinton's stance. This is another one of those things. He's going to do it. I mean, he promised he was going to do it. He's going to do it. And actually, from all the polling I've seen so far, majority of Americans actually favor this. So I think they feel a little more comfortable the second time around because they have these additional information of all these polls.
We should think of this, though, as symbolic. It's him trying to fulfill a campaign promise, but doing it in a fairly arbitrary fashion. Now, what I've heard is, and you may have heard the same stories, that they're going to drop a rock from the list of seven. That makes sense in many ways because a rock is more capable of providing vetting than some of these other countries where you would be worried about the vetting. There really is no government there to compile dossiers on people. That's less of a problem in Iraq. And then, of course, who was prevented entry? They were people who had worked with American soldiers in Iraq, where we have soldiers and a major investment. So I think the arbitrariness is what really tripped up the administration, the White House, in this. And they're going to back off and rethink this. Obviously, it is not done to meet an imminent threat, or they would have stuck to their guns a couple of weeks ago. And they obviously did not do that.
The president announced a new office in the Department of Homeland Security called VOICE, and that stands for Victims of Immigration Crime Engagement. He said it's a voice for those victims ignored by our media and silenced by our special interests. And Chris and Galena, you had a question about that?
I did. I thought I heard all of the air get sucked out of the room by the Democrats when he said that, what the acronym stood for. I wondered if it was something that nobody's heard anything about, or I just wondered if your guests could comment. And I just think it's another way to scare people about immigrants. And there were all of the guests that he had there who've been victims of crimes committed by immigrants or by people. It just seems so patronizing to me. I just wondered if they had any comments about that.
Yeah. Jack Torrey, was that a surprise to you? Did you know about this?
I didn't know about that. And I thought it was, in my own judgment, it was exploiting a hot-button issue because the vast majority of Americans who die every year in a violent fashion don't die at the hands of an illegal immigrant. Having said that, you know, these are real people who had family members killed. And so I guess you are, you know, it's perfectly legitimate to point that out to Americans. But the danger, of course, and I think Trump's, you know, immigrant language always is a little bit over the top. The danger is you're going to make an entire example out of an entire group of people, and that's just not right. It's not accurate.
Chris, thanks a lot for that call. Don in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Don.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
Oh, great. I had wanted to make an observation while I was watching the speech. Two things. One is that when I looked around in the audience at the guests and the security details surrounding President Trump, I was struck by the lack of diversity in the room as compared to President Obama's administration, and that made me kind of sad. because it just seems a lot less diverse to me in terms of, you know, representation of minorities in the audience. The second thing is that he didn't really address healthcare issues regarding women except for one line, and he just said something rather vague about supporting women's healthcare, and he sort of stuck that in a line with a lot of other topics. And when he said that, I just was kind of confused because I wasn't sure what he was referring to. It was just a very vague line, like, yes, we're going to support women's healthcare. And I was struck by the lack of specificity, and other than that one mention of it, not saying anything else. And that's very troubling to me because I'm just concerned that women's health care, with the reform or the repeal of ACA, will be detrimentally affected. My daughter has benefited directly from the ACA in terms of coverage of contraceptives.
Mm-hmm.
And so if things like that are changed, those types of measures, talking about cost savings, have been shown to reduce costs by providing some upfront and preventative services. So I was wondering if your guests could, first of all, if they remember that line and if they knew what he was talking about, and secondly, if they also had similar observations.
Okay. John, thanks a lot. Was he off script or on script, Jack?
No, yeah. I have no idea what he was talking about.
Yeah.
The Republicans, for some reason, have decided to relitigate the concept that access to contraceptives is a bad thing. I mean, this is a question that was settled back in the 1970s.
No, Jack, I don't think they are doing that. Jack, I think what it's about, the contraceptives issue is, should we force entities like the Little Sisters of the Poor to pay for and provide contraceptives to their employees? When a caller like this caller called in and said, well, I'm concerned about contraceptives, the Republicans have never said we are going to do away with birth control, the funding of it. All they've ever said about birth control is that they don't want to force individuals to provide that kind of coverage if they have a religious, you know, opposition to it. It's only in that small area. Now, Democrats want to expand that and make it seem like they're against all government funding or subsidies for birth control. But that is not the case. And Trump has said that many times on the campaign trail.
Jack?
I will only respond. I understand the point you're trying to make. But the fact is the Republican Party has dramatically shifted on this issue. In 1971, President Nixon delivered a speech in which he said contraceptives should be made available as widely as possible, even if you can't afford them. I cannot imagine a Republican president today saying such a thing and a Republican Congress going along with it. Yes, it is true. There are organizations that have religious exemptions. But this is broader than that. If I were if I had a daughter or if I were a young woman, this type of stuff would alarm me a lot, because I don't think that trying to curb access to contraceptives is a good thing for the country at this point. I thought it was settled when I was in college back in 1970.
let me just add in here for a second, and that is that one of the things the ACA did was it expanded the notion of preventative care to include a lot of things that affected women directly. And this was a very important part of the ACA. We will see going forward whether that stays in the package that the Republican Congress is able to put together or it goes. It's a cost.
It's a fundamental question, though. It's a debate about whether or not the cost is worth it in the long run.
Yes.
Because it'll save us money. The preventative care issues is a very important issue. We'll talk about that more. Let's see. Jeff in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, how you doing this morning, Ann?
Good, thanks.
So, I voted for Trump. In my mind, it was the lesser of two evils. And as I sat here listening to the speech last night, it struck me how much softer of a tone he was taking last night. And I was reminded that nothing that this man does is uncalculated. You know, for all of the showmanship and the cinematics for or whatever you want to call it, he knows what he's doing. And I think he came out swinging, knowing that he had the full majority during the inaugural address. Last night we saw him take a softer tone, because he does genuinely want to work with the Democrats and with the entirety of Congress. The problem that he runs into, though, is how does he do that without losing his base? And by taking this softer tone, he's saying, hey, I'm willing to work with everyone, but, you know, just remember, I can be this other way if you don't go along with what I want. So it is pure politics for someone who's never been a politician in his life.
It's like he's learning the art of politics.
He is, and yeah. It seems like he has a very, very short learning curve.
Thanks a lot, Jeff.
No problem.
He is learning the art of politics, which is, of course, the art of compromise. Mm-hmm. But how it comes across, but his base and a lot of that that marginal base that came out and voted sometimes for the first time, but voted for him, changed parties, that kind of a thing, switched over. They maybe aren't as interested in compromise.
Well, I mean, it's funny because everybody's kept talking about how they're waiting for President Trump to become more presidential. And I think we might have seen the very beginning of it. The big question is, will it continue? Mm-hmm. I don't know what to tell you. But, yeah, there a lot of his supporters do not want compromise. However, if we're going to get something done, you know, get things changed. You can't do – I mean, Barack Obama showed you can't get everything done through executive order. Mm-hmm. You got to get – things through Congress. And since Republicans control both houses of Congress, they're going to have to produce and show that they can get something done. And I think that is going to be the overriding factor in his relationship with Congress.
Something I noticed last night from, you know, watching the TV and Jack Tory, I don't know if you got a different sense about it from being in Washington, is, you know, we saw the Democratic women donning white to honor women's rights and the voting rights movement for women. And they also kept their distance when he entered and exited the chamber. And I really noticed that. That was a big difference from what I'd seen, you know, in the previous 25, 30 years. It's usually people reach across the aisle at that moment when the president is exiting and entering the chamber. To shake his hand, to acknowledge him, that sort of thing. Now, they don't always stand up and clap for everything he says, but, you know, from the opposing party. But what about that?
Well, I think this is the President of the United States, and he or she deserves the respect of that moment. And I don't think, if you don't want to take part in a joint address to Congress, then just don't go. I mean, when you're inside the chamber, mm-hmm. And I was not last night because I was on deadline. Here inside the chamber, it's very funny because he says something, the Republicans all stand up and clap, and the Democrats just sit there, and vice versa when mm-hmm. Obama was president.
Right.
But this is the President of the United States, and you do honor the office. And I just I think there are other ways to make a point, and that's not it.
Okay, well, Jack Tory, thanks for joining us. Appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
Jack Tory, D.C. Bureau Chief for the Columbus Dispatch. Also, Paul Beck, Ohio State University political scientist. Thanks to you as well.
Thank you, Ann.
And Bob Clegg, GOP strategist. Bob, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Ann.
That's it for All Sides today. Thanks so much for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.